It is Friday, August 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, VOA correspondent Greg Flakes describes the city of New Orleans 10 years ago after Hurricane Katrina struck.
In some areas, the water actually covered houses. There were people who had to break through they would go up into the attic of their house and they would break through the roof of their house and then crawl out.
Efforts are made to save Yazidi girls in Iraq, and we hear about New York City's Afropunk Festival. It's all ahead. New Orleans, Louisiana is commemorating the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. The city and the area around it was just devastated by the immense storm. VOA's Greg Flakes was on the scene shortly after Katrina struck, and Greg joins me on the line. Greg, when did you get to New Orleans following Hurricane Katrina?
Well, it was a few days afterwards, and the reason is, and I think it's important to point this out, is that although Hurricane Katrina struck on August 29th, it actually went or made land on right around the Louisiana-Mississippi border area, which is well to the east of New Orleans. And at first, people in New Orleans thought, oh, well, we ducked the bullet. Everything's going to be okay. And many people didn't realize for quite some time what had happened. And what had happened was that the levees had failed when a surge of water came up through the area around New Orleans, where the bay comes up and then into Lake Pontchartrain, which is actually to the north of the city. And all of these various levees then, several of them in various areas, had breaches that allowed water to start flowing into the city. And a couple days later, the water was even flowing down Canal Street, the main area of New Orleans.
When you got there, what were conditions like?
Well, what had happened was I think it was about 80% of the city was flooded, but to different degrees. And so some areas, the water was maybe, up to someone's ankles or up to their knees if they walked outside. But in some areas, the water actually covered houses. There were people who had to break through they would go up into the attic of their house and they would break through the roof of their house and then crawl out and be standing on the roof because that was the only part of the house that was above water. And then helicopters would come by and rescue some of those people. Now, at first, I was not able to even get into the city. My colleague, Brian Patton, was able to get someone on a boat and go in and see part of the city. But it took a while for those of us who weren't actually there when it happened to even get into the city to see it. In the meantime, I was encountering evacuees or people who had escaped the flooding, and they were all over the place. And these were not just people from New Orleans, by the way, but people from the Gulf Coast in general, which had really been devastated. So, the flooding that occurred in New Orleans drove out a lot of people to places as far as Houston, which filled up with people, and we had, of course, evacuees in the Astrodome here in Houston. But all along the way, in every part of Louisiana where I'd go, I would find people who had been displaced by the flooding, and I would be hearing their stories.
Do you think people were alerted enough as this storm approached? Because some people just decided to stay put, where others, got on the road and got out.
Well, yes, and that's been a controversial part of it for quite some time. But the studies that, have been done showed that there were a lot of people who simply ignored the warnings. There were other people who wanted to get out, but they were poor people who lived in some of these areas. They really didn't know where to go, and they were worried about their possessions and their houses, and they had the natural kind of inclination to stay there and keep watch on things. And they had some reliance in the levees. And by the way, the people in New Orleans today, many people there, do not regard this disaster as Hurricane Katrina as much as they call it the failure of the federal levees. And the studies have, in fact, shown, and the Army Corps of Engineers has admitted that the levees that they had created there pre-Katrina were not designed properly and were not, in many cases, constructed properly. And that's why you had these breaches, and so that places like the Lower Ninth Ward, a predominantly black neighborhood, which is to the east of, say, the French Quarter area that people would be familiar with, that area, you know, completely flooded. And when I was there, a week or two later, when I went into the area after the water had subsided, it looked like a war zone. I mean, there were upturned cars, houses that were just totally destroyed. In some cases, it looked like there was just debris left there, or there were lots that were completely empty because the water had such force coming through, it just removed the houses. And that area, even now, still has signs of what had happened.
You have just returned, just recently you were on a reporting trip to New Orleans. How has the city recovered, or has it recovered? Is it still recovering?
In some ways, it's still recovering, although, for the most part, it has recovered. Even the Lower Ninth Ward, if you go there, you'll see a lot of rebuilt homes, and you'll see people living there in neighborhoods that were, when I was there, 10 years ago, these were areas that just, as I say, just looked like a war zone. And today you go there and you don't see that. But you do see occasional empty lots. You do still see some houses that are just wrecks. And so those are reminders of what happened. And the empty lots, I think, hold testimony to the people who were not able to return and were not able to rebuild.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Greg, for speaking with me today.
Well, glad to do it. Thank you.
Okay. That's VOA correspondent Greg Flakus. Joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Andrew, how are social media sites reacting to this anniversary of Hurricane Katrina?
Well, the one fascinating thing that I realized this morning is that when Hurricane Katrina hit, there was no Twitter. Twitter was created in 2006 after this hurricane hit. So it's interesting to see now, 10 years later, how you're using it, how it's being incorporated. And so seeing a lot of people posting before and after pictures, you're seeing a lot of people, news organizations, posting coverage from the day of, kind of looking back, and a lot of pictures of the recovery. So it's generally very hopeful. Again, these before and after pictures, people saying, 10 years ago it was such a disaster and now we've come so far. And I'm sure we're going to see more of this into the weekend as the anniversary of the actual landfall comes this weekend. There's going to be remembrance ceremonies. There's going to be more coverage of that on social media. And I wouldn't be surprised if it was a top trending topic over the course of the weekend. Hashtag Hurricane Katrina, hashtag Katrina 10 year, things like that. It's also a big important anniversary today in the United States. It was 52 years ago today that Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his I Have a Dream speech on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial as part of the March on Washington. So we're seeing a lot of coverage on that. That's a top trending topic. People posting quotes from Martin Luther King Jr. and a lot of people asking, especially in light of recent racial incidents in the United States, is his dream being realized? Or is it, has it kind of fallen on deaf ears? So a lot of conversation, even, 50 plus years after the fact, still going on about that speech. And then Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook, made a big announcement yesterday. He said, on Monday, for the first time ever, 1 billion people used Facebook in a single day.
Wow.
So a huge milestone for them. Previously, they were saying it was about 900 million were checking it a day. And now they finally hit that 1 billion mark. They say about 1.5 billion people check their accounts at least once a month. And it's interesting to note here that they're saying 1 billion people checked Facebook within one day, but they're not including China because it's banned in China. But surely if there are people with VPNs or ways to get around those kind of blocks, there may be actually be more people than they're estimating. So I wouldn't be surprised if they come back and say, oh, actually, it's been a billion maybe for a little while. But certainly a big milestone for them and one that they've been trying to reach, I think, for a while. And now others, I'm sure, are going to try to emulate that and work towards that. Twitter and other social media aren't as big. They don't have as big audiences, but I'm sure they're going to try to work towards that and work some big milestones in themselves.
Yeah, well, it's a remarkable time there for Facebook.
Yeah.
Thanks, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. This is VOA.
Here's science in a minute. Renowned physicist and cosmologist Stephen Hawking recently said that he may have a solution to a 40-year-old cosmological mystery called the black hole information paradox. The theory of general relativity suggests that all physical information about an object would be permanently destroyed and lost after entering the black hole. However, this theory violates the laws of quantum mechanics. Hawking said that rather than actually swallowing and destroying this information, a black hole creates a 2D hologram of it. Garbled bits of information emitted by the hologram makes its way into the deep recesses of the black hole, where they, as Hawking suggested, could make their way out of the void via a passage to another universe. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, New York's Afropunk Festival. VOA correspondent Sharon Bain is in Erbil, Iraq, where she's been doing some reporting on the ground there. I believe you've been speaking with some Yazidis, particularly some brokers, who have been able to rescue some enslaved Yazidi girls.
Yeah, that was actually very, very interesting. I traveled up to where these Yazidi brokers are and spent time with two of them, asking them, you know, how are you doing this? And it's fascinating, actually, how they've been doing that. And at the very beginning, when a year ago, when ISIS attacked the Sinjar area and they started capturing all the Yazidi women, they immediately, these leaders within the Yazidi community had posted their numbers everywhere. And at that time, when the girls were first taken, many of them still had cell phones. And the Yazidi community was calling back to the girls, and these phone numbers of these brokers were being spread around the girls so that they had someone to call. And from that, and it's a very complicated sort of process, but from that, they've been able to keep in touch with some of these girls and then organize complex rescues where they will go in and actually sort of grab a girl out of an ISIS house and bring them to safety. It is a complex process. I'm simplifying it. But it's a rescue operation that several brokers are doing. There has been some criticism of some brokers that they're doing it for money. The ones that I spoke to said, absolutely not, we're not doing it for money, we're just doing it to rescue our girls. But they say, what they do say is that some of the middlemen, you know, that say there's a person who knows of a Yazidi girl who wants to get out, that middleman might demand money. And I also spoke to the UNHCR on this, and they said that, you know, that the families of these girls are so desperate. You know, they'll do anything, they'll pay anything to try to get their girls back. So there is probably some exploitation going on, but there are also appear to be some very honest brokers who are just trying to rescue the girls.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Sharon.
You're very welcome.
That's VOA's correspondent Sharon Bain reporting from Erbil, Iraq. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. Tens of thousands of people gathered in Brooklyn, New York's Commodore Barry Park recently for the Afropunk Festival. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA's Soul Lounge host, Shauna Renee, about the two-day art celebration that features headliners Grace Jones, Lenny Kravitz, and Lauryn Hill.
Oh, this was such an incredible event. So this is the 10th year. It started back in 2005. And it is an extremely important event for a couple of reasons. The primary one being is that it provides a space for people of African descent, African-American people, to exist and freely express themselves kind of outside of the normal labels that generally follow urban expression. So typically when you think about Black youth, you're thinking hip hop, you're thinking R&B, soul music. Well, these young Black folks like punk, they like rock, they like anything that you could, anything out there that they deem to be interesting and quality. So as you say, Grace Jones headlined, well, she headlined the first night, and anyone who knows Grace Jones knows
the incomparable Grace Jones.
The incomparable 67-year-old Grace Jones is liable to do anything. One thing we know she will do is grab a hula hoop and hula hoop her way through a song and a story and introductions of band members for minutes and minutes and minutes, and she absolutely did that. I saw so many videos of her. She was painted in Ebo tribal paint, yes.
And topless.
And she was, yes, she was topless.
Now, the reason I mention that is because she made a point, because last weekend in New York was also a protest march for going topless.
Mm-hmm.
You know, women are allowed to go topless in New York, as men are.
Right.
But apparently there was this big protest last weekend, and Grace kind of just joined into the whole thing and performed the whole set.
And again, at 67 years old, I mean, I hope that I have half that energy when I get to be her age. Lauryn Hill did a pretty good set as well. Now, Lauryn Hill has been known for being late. I mean, she did not disappoint in that regard, unfortunately.
50 minutes,
yeah,
something
she was
like that?
40, 50 minutes late. She sat down, did an acoustic set, which was kind of cool. Lenny Kravitz obviously did a remarkable job. I mean, he is quite the performer. And then in addition to the music, there's art. There's all kinds of cultural expression from sculpture to street art. Art, of course, fashion plays a huge part of this. So this gives you an opportunity to, again, see people of color in a way that we don't normally see them. And so this was in Brooklyn. They also have a festival in Atlanta. And very exciting, this is the first year that they're taking it to Paris.
Wow.
Yeah.
I know Grace is going to Paris.
Oh, absolutely.
All righty. Well, you know, if you have any questions or comments about this, you can send Shauna a tweet. She's at VOA Lady DJ. You can also hit her up at @VOA_music. You can also listen for her show, The Soul Lounge, on our website. That's www.voanews.com. Listen what I say.
That's the sounds of Lenny Kravitz, who performed recently at New York's Commodore Barry Park. Well, in other news, the Apple Company has sent out mysterious invitations to a new product event for September 9th, but has not said exactly what will be announced, which is standard practice for the technology company, which often launches new products in September. Media outlets on Thursday received invitations to the event carrying the headline, "Hey Siri, give us a hint." Siri is the name for the voice-activated personal assistant function contained in Apple devices. Now, while the exact nature of the announcement has not been revealed, industry observers say it is likely to be a new iPhone model or a new version of the Apple TV set-top box, which allows a standard television to display streaming content. Apple event announcers usually generate a great deal of interest because of how closely the company guards its information. When Siri users question their electronic device about the purpose of the September 9th event, she answers enigmatically, saying only to expect a big announcement. Well, at the beginning of the show, we heard about Hurricane Katrina, which struck New Orleans, Louisiana, 10 years ago. Well, now storm warnings are out for more than a dozen Caribbean islands as Tropical Storm Erica approaches after killing at least four people on Dominica. Crews are searching for several people reported missing on Dominica, where Erica soaked the island with 38 centimeters of rain. Flooding from the torrential rains washed out roads and downed power lines, cutting off electricity across the island. Forecasters say Erica likely will hit the Virgin Islands, the Dominican Republic, and the Leeward Islands Friday and Saturday. U.S. forecasters say Erica could strengthen into a hurricane and strike the east coast of Florida by Monday, but they stress that the exact storm track is uncertain. The U.S. National Security Advisor says the U.S. and China have discussed frankly their differences over the past year as the two nations prepare for Chinese President Xi Jinping's visit to the United States next month. Susan Rice is in Beijing, where she met with China's top diplomat, Yang Jiechi, and President Xi. President Xi is set to come to the U.S. in late September to pay a state visit to President Barack Obama and to address the United Nations General Assembly. The White House has said the interactions between U.S. and Chinese officials are focused on building a more productive relationship between the two countries. Yang told reporters after his meeting with Rice that China wants to make sure the president's visit to Washington is a complete success. Rice's visit comes as stock markets around the world have seen unusual volatility. Well, that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks very much for joining us and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On August 25th, a Russian military court found Ukrainian filmmaker Oleg Sentsov and Ukrainian activist Oleksandr Kolchenko guilty of politically motivated fabricated charges and sentenced Mr. Sentsov to 20 years and Kolchenko to 10 years in prison. The charges against Mr. Sentsov and Mr. Kolchenko are baseless and violate their human rights. The case against them rested on testimony obtained through torture, which in at least one case was retracted because it had been coerced. Indeed, Russia singled out Sentsov and Kolchenko for exercising their freedom of speech within a sovereign Ukraine, where they expressed their vocal opposition to Russia's purported annexation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. On May 11, 2014, Russia's Federal Security Service arrested Oleg Sentsov at his home in Simferopol, Crimea, territory the international community recognizes as part of Ukraine and where Russia has no legal jurisdiction. A Ukrainian filmmaker whose work had garnered international attention, Sentsov had just taken part in a rally to support the Euromaidan protests in Kiev and to oppose Russia's occupation of Crimea. Similarly, Russian occupational authorities arrested Oleksandr Kolchenko, a pro-Ukrainian activist, 5 days later. Both were illegally transported to Russia, forcibly assigned Russian citizenship to deprive them of their rights as foreign citizens, and held in detention without trial for over a year. The United States strongly condemns the trial and sentencing of film director Oleg Sentsov and activist Oleksandr Kolchenko as groundless, a violation of human rights, and a contravention of international law. This is clear miscarriage of justice, said State Department spokesman John Kirby. Both Ukrainians were taken hostage on Ukrainian territory, transported to and imprisoned in Russia, and had Russian citizenship imposed on them against their wills. They have reported abuses by Russian authorities, who also restricted their access to lawyers, family, and others while in jail for more than a year. Mr. Sentsov and Mr. Kolchenko were targeted by authorities because of their opposition to Russia's attempted annexation of Crimea, said spokesperson Kirby. The United States stands by those who are persecuted for exercising their rights to speak freely and engage in peaceful protest. We again call upon the Russian Federation to implement the commitments it made in signing the Minsk agreements by immediately releasing Oleg Sentsov, Alexander Kolchenko, Nadia Savchenko, and all other remaining hostages.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.